From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. How has U.S. policy towards human rights around the world changed under President Obama? In our first half hour, we put that question to Burns Weston, a senior scholar at the University of Iowa Center for Human Rights. Then a conversation with Jane Olson, chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. Olson will be speaking at Drake University Wednesday evening. She'll tell us about the survivor stories she has witnessed in 30 years of travel to war zones in Nicaragua, the former Yugoslavia, and the Soviet Union. That's all coming up this hour. First, let's take a look at the news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we focus on human rights around the world. How has U.S. human rights policy changed a little over a year into the Obama presidency? Later in the hour, a conversation I had earlier today with Jane Olson, chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. Olson, an Iowa native, will be speaking at Drake University Wednesday evening. She'll provide observations from her 30 years of travel to war zones in Nicaragua, the former Yugoslavia, and the Soviet Union. But first, I'm joined in our studio by another esteemed name in international human rights who is connected with Iowa, Burns Weston. Burns Weston is the Bessie Dutton Murray Distinguished Professor of Law Emeritus and Senior Scholar at the University of Iowa Center for Human Rights. Good afternoon to you, Professor Weston.
Greetings, Ben. Nice to be here.
Little over a year into the Obama presidency, how does this president compare to the last in terms of human rights policy, from what we can tell now?
Well, I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. On the one hand, Obama has done some pretty good things. He's appointed a very, very esteemed and learned fellow to be a legal advisor to the State Department. I'm referring to former dean of the Yale Law School, Harold Coe. He has gotten the United States back onto the Human Rights Council, from which it was banished during the Bush years. He has declared that torture is not a policy that the United States will pursue in the future. And so far as I can tell, that is the case. He's tried to very self-consciously to limit civilian casualties in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan, and he's at least indicated an interest in joining the landmines treaty to ban landmines. On the other hand, some of this stuff is more a matter of rhetoric than it is of actual action, and it's a little hard to make a complete assessment because we are, after all, only 1 year out on the administration, and it has been so single-mindedly in the last several months absorbed by the whole healthcare process and the rather nasty politics that have gone on throughout that process that there's been, I think, some difficulty in following through on some of the things that he's projected.
Okay. We want to reach out to our listeners. Burns Weston with us until half past the hour. Ask our listeners, what are your questions about U.S. human rights policy under the Obama administration? And many points that Professor Weston just mentioned, perhaps you have an opinion or a question about one of those. 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. What are your human rights concerns in the year 2010? Now, you mentioned some positive aspects of the Obama administration on human rights. What do you see as disappointing in your eyes?
Well, there are several things. I wish that the Obama administration would come out right away and indicate that the United States would join the International Criminal Court, which it withdrew from under the Bush administration. I wish that it would push the Women's Convention, otherwise known as CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. It has not done that. I wish it would rescind the Bush ending of the right of habeas corpus, a fundamental human right that goes back to the Magna Carta. Carter, excuse me. I wish most of all that he would in fact prosecute for those who committed torture. And this to me is actually one of the biggest problems that I have with President Obama in the human rights area. The United States is a party to the Convention on the Prohibition of Torture. Under that treaty, the United States is legally obligated to prosecute people who under its jurisdiction have committed torture. He and his attorney general have both acknowledged that waterboarding, for example, is a form of torture. And yet he's come out and said, you know, he believes in thinking about the future rather than the past, mm-hmm. and therefore has not indicated any willingness to prosecute.
So what were the pressures on him, you think, to change his mind if indeed that's what he did about the prosecution of those who committed torture?
I don't know, because it came so early in his presidency. He said this within a matter of just a month or two after entering the White House. So it's hard for me to know what the pressures were. It seems to me he had a great opportunity to take a very bold step and show that the United States was very serious about punishing as well as not doing – engaging in torture, punishing for it. So I'm puzzled. It's unlike, for example, Guantanamo or the Don't Ask, Don't Tell with the military. These are issues which have been immersed in domestic politics, and there's all kinds of problems there in being able to get things done easily. But it seems to me that the president has complete authority under the Torture Convention, under the U.S. Constitution, to prosecute for torture, and he's just not
done it. And what would be the danger in your eyes for future generations of not prosecuting past torture in looking only toward the future in this sense?
Well, I mean, the point is if you don't, you're giving, in essence, license to other countries not to prosecute their people either. And that's a very, very, very dangerous prospect indeed.
Before we go to calls, I want to address something you just mentioned. Closing Guantanamo has mm-hmm. been a signature promise of Obama's presidency, mm-hmm. and it is still unkept, well past his original deadline.
Well, it's not completely unkept. Some people have been released. Some people have been pulled up.
But closing of Guantanamo.
The actual closing of it, yeah. There's still 200 prisoners there.
The deadline he gave originally was in January. That has not been kept is what I meant there. Now, what are the implications if President Obama fails to shut the U.S. military's Cuban prison?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's going to send a pretty terrible signal around the world about the seriousness or lack thereof with which the Obama administration is committed to pursuing policies that have nothing to do with this sort of maltreatment of people. And, of course, that's going to impact certainly on the left, political left. That's going to impact against him, I think. It will be seen as one more instance in which he'll be accused of caving in to right-wing pressures. And in this case, I think that would be inappropriate. I mean, his recent sort of flirtation with taking people out of the civilian courts and putting them into military tribunals.
With Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think if he does that, that would be a very horrible thing. It would be horrible for two reasons, Ben. One, because the civilian courts have proven that they are, in fact, more effective. In fact, General Powell has said as much, that they have proven to be far more effective not only in prosecuting but in punishing people. Most, I think something like 9 or 10 people have been prosecuted in civilian courts, and all of them have gone to prison. Whereas I think the military tribunals have only tried 3 people, and only one has gone to prison, and 2 others have been released and gone back and already been found to be somewhat, to some extent, recidivists in the use and practice of torture. So I think it would be a bad thing just from a purely practical point of view, but it's also going to be bad politically.
Okay. We have a number of callers who want to join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. Your questions for Professor Burns Weston about U.S. human rights policy under the Obama administration. Let's go first to Keith in Iowa Falls. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have a question. Something that I found chilling was extraordinary rendition. Do we still practice that? Could you define exactly what it is or where it might be justified?
Okay, Keith, thank you very much.
That's a good question. In fact, as far as I know, there are the practice of extraordinary rendition is not being practiced by the Obama administration right now. There's no evidence anywhere that that is now taking place. If you're asking me whether I think that sort of thing is justified, the answer is no.
I have one other question. Do we still operate any black sites? Or maybe you don't know because they're so black.
Good question.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, if there are black sites, how would I know?
Right.
as far as you know.
As best I know. As a fact, we just had here in Iowa City recently the UN's special rapporteur on torture, which is the top guy in the representing the UN on the issue of torture. And he's from Austria. He's a wonderful lawyer from Austria, University of Vienna, and gave several speeches. And he confirmed on several different occasions while he was here this last week that what I just said is true, that there is no evidence of the Obama administration engaging in this kind of activity.
Okay, Keith, thank you from Iowa Falls. Let's go quickly to Dubuque, where Marcos is. Marcos, we've got a couple minutes before the break. What's on your mind?
In my mind, it is Latin America. That means, you know, the School of the Americas is still there operating, and especially my concern right now is Honduras. You know, we have been very weak criticizing the coup, and now there is, with the new government of Lobo that we fully support, there have been tons of reports about human rights abuses. Do you have any more information, and what's your take regarding the School of the Americas and human rights? Thank you.
Thank you, Marcos. Perhaps remind our listeners of what happened in Honduras in the last half months, half year.
Well, in the recent years, because of the issue with the presidency,
yes,
the president of Honduras,
I mean.
Being essentially thrown out by a military revolt. But the specific question is about the School of the Americas. As mm-hmm. far as I know, it's still ongoing. It's still training military personnel to be put into the Latin American military forces. It's a operation with which I completely disagree. I wish we would abandon it. I have not heard anything from the Obama administration that it will do so.
Okay. Your chief concern in terms of human rights in Latin America currently?
Well, actually, in the last, how shall we say, the last decade or so, Latin America has changed dramatically from the standpoint.
Since the Reagan years.
Yes, dramatically. That's right.
Okay, let's come back to our discussion with Professor Burns Weston when we return. And your questions and comments are welcome. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Burns Weston, senior scholar at the University of Iowa Center for Human Rights, with us until half past the hour. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few minutes, a conversation with Jane Olson, chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. Olson will be speaking at Drake University Wednesday evening, tomorrow evening. She'll tell us in a few minutes about the survivorship stories she has witnessed in 30 years of travel to war zones in Nicaragua, the former Yugoslavia, and the Soviet Union. Currently, we have Burns Weston with us live in our studio, senior scholar at the University of Iowa Center for Human Rights, and also a professor of law emeritus at the University of Iowa. To join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Within the last few months, or I guess this was last year, a major policy paper that you were involved with an interesting title. I want to ask you about it, called Recalibrating the Law of Humans with the Laws of Nature, Climate Change, Human Rights, and Intergenerational Justice. What is that about?
Well, one of the things that we've discovered as a result of a 3-year major research project was that the law of the United States, the law of most countries, international law, really law from local to global, does not adequately protect the rights of future generations to a clean, healthy, and stable, sustainable environment. So what this paper's been all about has been to document that and then to come up with a number of recommendations as to how some of that can be alleviated, all the way from adding constitutional provisions to our state constitutions to ensure that the rights of future—that is to say, the ecological rights of future generations will be recognized in legislation and in judicial decisions. Statutes for state legislatures, indeed statutes for the federal government, for the federal Congress to enact. We've proposed resolutions for the UN and a variety of activities that are legally oriented but trying to bring the law to bear upon the dire consequences of something as severe as climate change.
Mm-hmm. What difference could that make when we connect the environment with human rights and intergenerational justice, when we're dealing with the realities of business, growing economies? We always hear we don't want to harm the growth of our economy. It seems what I'm saying, to be straightforward, is it seems that human rights are so far removed from the practical nature of what we're concerned about in our politics every day.
I think that's true. I think that human rights do not take or are not given the deference that they should be given when making our policy. And that's not just with respect to the environment. It's respect to foreign trade, for example. The WTO generally does not take into account the human rights impacts of many of its decisions. Certainly that's also true of the monetary policies of the IMF and the World Bank. But it's also true they don't take into account environmental issues either. What we're trying to recommend here is that we have to have a paradigm shift. We have to be thinking differently. And the way to get at that one way, certainly not the only way, but one way, is to get the law or our legal systems in line with what's best for the planet. That's the only planet we got. And if we screw it up, it's not going to be good for the future.
You've been dealing with human rights issues and also the environment for many decades. Have you seen any movement in this toward this paradigm shift?
On this particular paradigm shift?
Yes.
No.
Not at all?
No, very little. I mean, marginally, let's put it that way. There are treaties here and there. There are statutes here and there that purport to regulate various aspects of the environment, but none of them have been effective enough to offset the extremely deleterious consequences that are going to flow from climate change if we don't do something mighty, mighty fast to deal with it.
Can you serve? Have you analyzed what areas, what populations will be most affected by climate change negatively?
I would say probably the most the people who would fall into that category would be largely people in poor countries, and particularly countries that are on sea coasts. I'm thinking of a country like Bangladesh, for example. Many island countries in the South Pacific would be another example. The Inuits in the Arctic, still another example. But to say that is to make it sound very remote. Mm-hmm. In fact, much of what we've been experiencing in the United States, Katrina being a prime example, the flood here in Iowa 2 years ago.
But climate experts can't tie those things directly.
Yes, they can. What you can say is that the warming of the planet and is going up to such a significant degree faster than most people anticipated, that the warming of the climate doesn't mean you're not going to have a cold winter. What it means is you're going to have more violent weather, more extreme weather. So you can see more tornadoes, more hurricanes, mm-hmm. more floods.
I'm just thinking that basing climate change on the last few years of weather is like people on the conservative right end of the spectrum saying, well, we have a very cold winter. Therefore, global warming can't be true.
But climate and temperature are not the same thing. Okay. That's the key. Climate and temperature are not the same thing. You may have an even colder weather. For example, if global warming proceeds to the degree some scientists project, it's possible that the Gulf Stream could be so affected by the warming of the Atlantic Ocean that it would cause a shift in the flow of the Gulf Stream, which would lead to the freezing over in a new ice age of much of northern Europe. Now, that's a long distance off. But it's not that far away that we must not do something about it now. And let me just make clear, Ben, the reason I'm concerned about this is because not only the rights of future generations, but rights of our young people today are going to be very seriously – my grandchildren are going to be very seriously affected by our failure to deal with these fundamental environmental questions. And these affect their human right to life, their human right to habitat, their human right to good health. All these things are affected.
Well, we have just a few minutes left. I wanted to address this. The Human Rights Watch recently has called on the U.S. and Yemen to take all possible precautions to ensure civilians are not harmed during operations against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Are you now satisfied with the degree to which our military, and it does seem by media reports that our military is being more sensitive, currently guarding against civilian casualties in the pursuit of insurgents?
My impression – I'm not an expert on this, but I can say this much, that my impression is that the military has been paying much closer attention to trying to adhere to the Geneva Conventions and the laws of war with respect to maintaining a distinction between combatants and civilian population. That's very, very hard to do when the enemy is an elusive enemy and that often uses civilians as hostages to protect themselves, as shields against the attack of those who would want to eliminate them. And so it's a very problematic issue, and there's going to always be some margin of error. But I must say it is better than it has been.
Okay, let's talk to Julie quickly before you have to go in just a couple minutes. Julie, please make it quick. What would you like to contribute?
Yes, I would just like your guest to comment on the human rights situation in Israel. It looks like an apartheid state to me. What is his take on it? And I'll take the call off the air.
Thank you, Julie, calling from Cedar Falls.
I would agree with that assessment. It is somewhat of an apartheid state, as much as people don't like to hear that word used in that context. We're over 40 years of essentially no progress in resolving the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, and I think it's fundamental that it must be resolved, and we must be taking the rights of the Palestinians as seriously as we take the rights of the Israelis. If we don't, then I think we're going to have continued unhappiness in the Middle East, because I think it's at the root of many of our problems.
Okay, very good. 30 seconds left to tell us what you're working on right now. What do you, for the future, the coming months?
It's a very abstract thing I'm working on. I'm working on the development of what's called commons law. That is to say, to look at the global commons and figure out ways in which we can make those commons, like the atmosphere, the oceans, and other such things, responsible to individual human beings.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Perhaps have you back to talk specifically about
those.
Sure,
let's have another program.
Burns Weston, I want to thank you very much for stopping into our studio and talking with us. It's been a pleasure having
you. Thank you, Ben.
Burns Weston, Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa, Law Professor Emeritus, also Senior Scholar at the University of Iowa Center for Human Rights. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation I had earlier today with Jane Olson, Chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. Olson will be speaking at Drake University Wednesday evening. In just a few minutes, she'll tell us about the survivorship stories she has witnessed in 30 years of travel to war zones in Nicaragua, the former Yugoslavia, and the Soviet Union. That when we return, Jane Olson. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, our focus on human rights. Jane Olson is an Iowa native and chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. She has spent much of the last 30 years traveling to war-torn parts of the world, including Yugoslavia during the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, and Africa during the Rwandan genocide and the civil war in Burundi. She's coming to Drake University tomorrow night to share the survivorship stories she's witnessed in those travels. I talked with Ms. Olson in advance of her visit and asked her first about how U.S. policy towards human rights may have changed under the Obama administration.
Well, I think when Obama was elected, we certainly saw the entire world joyfully anticipating transformation, especially in the world of peace and justice and human rights. I think the very idea that he promoted the conversations with our enemies, that he would greet Chavez in Venezuela, that he would make innuendos towards Iran, that he would open diplomatic channels that had been closed during the Bush administration, gave everybody great hope for the future. I think he still will intend to push for diplomatic solutions to problems that have seemed very entrenched and certainly got worse during the Bush administration. I know that at Human Rights Watch we've been disappointed in some of the initiatives that he has stated rather emphatically and then backed down on.
For instance?
Well, I think in Israel, announcing that the peace settlement depended on Israel freezing its building of new settlements, I think he stated that fairly positively and emphatically, and then Israel announced it was going to proceed to build 600 new living units in East Jerusalem, which is supposed to be Palestinian, and apparently they're going on with 900 units in East Jerusalem. That certainly makes it more difficult to proceed with peace talks and a solution in the Israeli-Palestinian long-entrenched problem. Also in Guantanamo, we're very concerned about whether or not these cases get tried in civilian courts or whether it goes back to some kind of a military court. I think the civilian courts in the United States are very capable of handling these cases. I think there's a great deal of fear attached to anything around these terrorists, and people that have been held a long time in Guantanamo deserve justice, but those who are left are, of course, the worst of the worst, and people are afraid to bring them into the United States and to expose them to the possibility of civilian justice and all the security issues and costs around that. But I'm sad to see him back down, just on personally I am.
Right. You say you're disappointed at Human Rights Watch on some points with the Obama administration. At the same time, you understand the political pressures that he's under and that he couldn't have perhaps lived up to the campaign rhetoric on human rights. Could he have?
Right. And in Afghanistan, I think during his campaign, he announced his plans for Afghanistan. I don't think that was any surprise.
To be hawkish on Afghanistan.
Right. Mm-hmm. I always think that war should be the very last solution, and I don't see that it is a hopeful solution in Afghanistan, and certainly hasn't been in Iraq. But he did say what he was going to do, and he's followed up. I just think the difference is he's putting a timeline on our operations in Iraq, and I know that Iowa has suffered more than its share of losses in that terrible war, so I will be very happy to see the troops come home and hope that peace can be sustained there.
As the U.S. has stepped up its campaign in Afghanistan, also in Yemen, would you say the U.S. military has been better at reducing the number of civilian deaths and injuries when targeting insurgents?
Well, I can't speak for Human Rights Watch. I will speak for myself personally. I think, at Human Rights Watch, we never give an opinion as to whether a war is justified, whether we should go to war, because our job is to comment on the conduct of war. And the most important thing is protecting civilians, limiting civilian loss as much as possible, and making sure that all targets have military justification. I think in Afghanistan, what's disturbing to me personally is the use of these unmanned drones, the surveillance planes that seem to have inflicted a number of very troubling incidences of civilian death. 27 innocent people killed and going after one terrorist suspect in an incident last week, and a continuing report of civilian loss. I think it's almost impossible, given the topography of Afghanistan, to ensure where the terrorist suspects are exactly, and and who's around them. I think the use of these predators certainly has limited loss of American lives, but I think it has perhaps, unfortunately and unintentionally, caused civilian deaths that are a great tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And will really hinder our cause, because it makes it easier for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to recruit people angry at the United States and the Allied forces for traumas that are caused in villages where many innocent people are lost.
Jane Olson is my guest, if you've just joined us, chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. Jane, Wednesday evening you'll be speaking at Drake University about what you call the survivorship stories that you have witnessed in 30 years of travel to war zones in Nicaragua, the former Yugoslavia, and in the Soviet Union. I'd like to have you tell us about some of these experiences you've had and why you're bringing these survivorship stories to Iowa. Where would you like to take us first?
Well, I guess the experience that was most transformative in my life was the ethnic cleansing of Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia. I went there in the early stages of that war in 1992 and went back many times to witness what was happening and to come back. And I did many radio interviews and television interviews, spoke in universities and churches and synagogues, trying to tell people that, you know, the war over there was horrendous, and, you know, ethnic cleansing was anything but clean. It was really a devastating massacre of innocent civilian lives and destruction of whole towns and villages on a scale that I'd never personally witnessed before. And I felt, you know, it was very important for the international community to intervene to stop what I saw as a land grab and an attack. The victims were primarily Bosnian Muslims who were secular Muslims, but I went over many times and saw firsthand what was happening to civilians and the creation of massive refugee camps where people were, you know, living in horrendous conditions. And, of course, refugee camps are always 80% women and children and the elderly. And what I found is I would come home and talk about, you know, 500,000 refugees, hundreds of thousands of people killed or injured, you know, the massive use of rape as a weapon of war. And my audiences just couldn't relate to those numbers. And I began just telling personal stories. Mm-hmm. And I found that if I put a face on the victim, it helped people to care, because we can sort of take in one person's story, but to talk about huge numbers, tens of thousands of victims, I think people just feel that it's overwhelming. And I also learned that if I looked for signs of hope and people who were surviving and working on reconciliation in their own lives and communities, that it was easier to both to sustain my energies for working on this issue and also to make people care, to be inspired that there was a solution and that people were really able to sustain and rebuild their lives.
It's interesting that you brought up the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. Because of our previous talk of the bombing in Afghanistan and unintended civilian casualties, there we have a case where the U.S. led a bombing campaign to stop the ethnic cleansing. How are those two things different? We have some unintended casualties in Afghanistan. We did then in Bosnia. Both are trying, the bombing campaigns are trying to avoid a greater evil, if you will.
Well, there's no question about it. And in all of these war zones, I have met with peacekeeper troops, the United Nations peacekeeping troops in Bosnia. They were called UNPROFOR. And I've met with American troops. You know, we were engaged in Bosnia and dropping food and medical supplies into regions where refugees were cut off and unable to be reached by road because the siege that was 1,000 days in Sarajevo and in eastern Bosnia. And always our troops were so eager to save lives and to bring sustenance to people. I don't think that the loss of innocent lives is ever intended. I always think it's a terrible accident, but that's the case of war. And I think more often than not, we're seeing these unintended consequences in Afghanistan, in part because it is such a complex topography. We really don't know exactly where people are, and with the hills, mountains, and valleys, you know, trying to target specifically is practically impossible.
In your 30 years of travel to war zones, I'd like you to pick out one story to tell us. You said people best connect not with hearings of thousands of people affected, but refugees, people affected by war. Can you pick out one short story that you might share with us now?
You know, I have great passion for Africa. I've been many, many times to various countries in Africa. My most recent trip to Africa was to Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi. In Rwanda, of course, they had the terrible genocide of 800,000 people killed in just 100 days, starting in April of 1994. My last trip there, I really saw wonderful signs of peace and reconciliation. There are women who are leading efforts to rebuild homes, Hutu women and Tutsi women. The Hutus were the primarily perpetrators and Tutsis primary victims of the genocide, and they're working together to rebuild each other's homes, to rebuild each other's families, to celebrate births and families and so on. In Burundi, we were meeting with children, young adults, who had been used as child soldiers in a civil war that was fought along the same lines as in Rwanda. It wasn't as well known in the media because the genocide in Rwanda was so dramatic and sudden. But in Burundi, they had a what I would call genocide in slow motion, a civil war that took place over 20 years. And again, it was fought along ethnic and tribal lines. We met with some young women in the capital city of Bujumbura in Burundi who talked to us about their experience of having been taken into the militia when they were 10, 12, 13 years old and forced to serve as wives of the soldiers. They were made to carry heavy burdens, frequently gang raped. They were really abused in such horrendous ways you can't imagine. And we were working with the women to try to get them legal aid for claims that they had against the perpetrators and for property rights from homes that had been stolen from their families. Their families had been killed, but they were trying to recover some property. And to hear these young women tell their stories, first of all, to have the courage to tell their stories, to name their abusers when the abusers are still, you know, very likely to come after them for retribution, it just made me feel so proud of them. Many places I go, I am a grandmother. I have 8 grandsons, but I find grandmothers can go just about anywhere, and we don't instill very much fear. So to sit in a circle with these young women, it felt to me so almost primal and universal to gain their confidence, to hear them tell their stories of long, horrendous abuse with real hope that they were going to find justice and real hope for their futures. They were applying for jobs as police women in the capital city, and one of them had gotten a job, was wearing her uniform. She was so proud and rebuilding her life. But it just also gives me a sense of tremendous responsibility to, you know, follow through to make sure that they get help and protection. And I always feel I sort of adopt these young women and want to go back and check in on them in a year or two and see how they're doing.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Jane Olson, chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. She'll be giving a free public lecture titled Survivorship Stories from 30 Years of War Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. at Drake University. Yesterday was International Women's Day. I wonder if we can step back and have you give us a bigger picture on your reflections on progress with regards to women's rights and the changes still needed after that story of women in Africa.
On women's rights, it always seems to me to be two steps forward and one and a half back, but I think the progress is forward. One of the really hopeful things for me is the way that women are networking around the world. It's been almost 20 years since we had the Women's Conference in Beijing, the United Nations Women's Conference, and from that conference came the recommendation that funders invest in women. The whole idea of small microloans to women in third world countries was really born out of that, and it took quite some time to get that message into the broader psyche of the donor nations. But, you know, from the example of the Grameen Bank, who won the Nobel Peace Prize some years ago for their microloans to women, that it has been so successful, and we're seeing it just flourish in large and small donors supporting women in developing countries by giving them small loans. They're finding that, you know, some 90% of the loans are paid back, and that when you invest in women, you are also investing in their children, because women will spend the money on educating their children, and especially girl children who otherwise wouldn't be allowed to go to school. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing tremendous progress in understanding the need to support women and to educate girls. This is a way of really giving them a chance to be world citizens.
Uh-huh. And by putting more economic power in the hands of women, that causes other beneficial changes?
Well, it builds strong families. You know, I have great respect for men, believe me, but men do not tend to spend extra money they get on their families in these third world countries. You know, they would more likely spend it gambling or drinking. We see this all over the place. And women will invest in planting a garden or livestock or doing crafts or something that they can sell on the market. And they repay the loans. They then use the money to buy school uniforms for their children and get their children educated. In terms of leadership on women's rights and women's issues, the other thing I find hopeful is that women are connecting. Women leaders, we now have women presidents on several continents, and I think they're showing a different way of leadership. And it's, you know, it's very hopeful and inspirational to those of us who care about women's rights issues, mm-hmm. to see how they have been transforming their countries. We have a woman leader in Liberia, and a delegation just went down to visit with her. She's just done remarkable things in Liberia. Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, I went to visit last August, and she was a political prisoner under Pinochet. Her father had been a general in the Allende government in Chile, and she herself has a master's degree in military strategy, and she is a practicing pediatrician. As president of Chile, she was just doing remarkable things to both move forward the justice system from the terrible disappearances and torture that happened under Pinochet, but she was also working for forgiveness and rehabilitation and reconciliation.
Jane Olson, we've come almost to the end of our time here. I wanted to ask you a final question here. You are a native of Iowa, of Denison, Iowa, and you have devoted your life to international justice and humanitarian work. When did you first feel the calling to become involved in human rights? Are those roots in Iowa?
Well, I'm very proud of my Iowa roots. I was born and raised in Denison, and we still own a farm in Iowa, my husband and I, and visit often. We're there, you know, several times a year to visit. I think when you talk to people in Iowa, you realize that there are many, many Iowans who are world travelers. I think when we're raised there, we realize the world is not going to come to us, to the heartland, that we need to travel and seek out international adventure ourselves. And I find Iowans all over the world who have, active curiosity and want to travel and see the world. For myself, I became particularly interested in conflict because I was a journalism major, and I think the war correspondents were my heroes. And I just became really fascinated with the idea of journalistic coverage of conflict and survival in war zones. That was my dream, but when I graduated from college, I could only get a job as editor of the women's pages in a newspaper in Michigan. And I found I found another way to keep my dream alive by traveling with international humanitarian and human rights organizations all around the world and seeking out stories, which through my photography and writing skills I've been able to bring back and tell and share. I'm going to be trying to talk about stories from various parts of the world tomorrow at Drake that I hope will put a face on survivors and interest people in learning more about these situations.
Jane Olson, I want to thank you very much for this discussion. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Jane Olson talking by phone with us from Ann Arbor. She's chair of the International Board of Human Rights Watch. Jane will be giving a free public lecture titled Survivorship Stories from 30 Years of War. That's Wednesday at 7 p.m. at Drake University. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.